There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad that you could join me here for a little bit of classic cardboard conversation. And we've got a classic set that a lot of people don't think is classic. But let me tell you, without this set, there would be a whole lot of naive, lost children from the 1980s trying to collect baseball cards. I know it sounds like a Sally Struthers commercial.
For just 17 cents a day, you can help these kids get better baseball cards.
That sounds more like Edith Bunker. Stifle! Anyways, this was a very influential set, not just for a lot of kids in the 1980s, and I would even say into the early 1990s. Because pre-internet, this offered an awesome history lesson, not just on baseball cards, but the sport of baseball itself. And we can still draw a lesson today to the 1982 Topps Kmart set. It was all about MVPs. And in 1982, when it came to suburbia shopping, Kmart was your MVP. Most valuable place. Because if you lived too far away from a mega mall, you know, nowadays they're everywhere, but big shopping malls were not quite as plentiful 40 or so years ago. And if you lived too far from a downtown city center, even though they were dying in the early 80s because everybody was moving to the suburbs, some still had some mega department stores. But if you were like, 80% of the nation's population in 1982, chances are you didn't live within a 30 or 40 minute drive to a downtown city center or a mega mall. But you were at least a stone's throw from the nearest Kmart. So we're not going to just talk about this particular set. We're going to talk a little bit about some Kmart memories, too, because I've got some of those. Because, boy, what an innocent time it was when everything you needed could be found at Kmart. And I know it certainly helped my family's budget with three young boys growing up. Mom and Dad were not rolling in the dough, so we purchased quite a bit from Kmart. And other imposters that were still in the region that I grew up in. But there's a cautionary tale that I think lines up rather nicely here. Your 1962 creation in the retail world, not just Kmart, but Walmart. And the rise and fall of Kmart almost happened to the baseball card industry at roughly the same time. It is fascinating when you line Kmart, Walmart, and the baseball card hobby right next to each other. There are some similarities in timelines and almost a similarity in a demise. Thankfully, the hobby is alive and well. Kmart, by the way, is still alive. It is far from well. It has been far from well for a very, very long time. But even though the hobby isn't quite what it used to be, say, 30 or 40 years ago, thankfully it is in a better position. than Kmart, and some may argue Walmart. So we'll talk about that. My introduction to the set, which comes through family. No, not my mother, who you by now know introduced me to purchasing baseball cards. Not my father, who, of course, as a big baseball fan, was very influential on me continuing to stay involved in the sport and the hobby. No, it's actually all my older brother's fault. So I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But first, I do want to welcome you to Wax Ecstatic. We are coming your way every other Friday. And if you didn't catch last week's show on 86 Donruss, you missed a good one. A lot of fans of 86 Donruss. And again, I have talked myself away from building that set because after opening the three packs, and I already have probably about 100 other cards from 86 Donruss. Actually, maybe not even that. Maybe like 70 or 80. But anyways, I've got somewhere, I'm floating around 100 or so cards. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, it's only 660 cards. Be pretty easy to get. Nope. Try not to add another log to the fire here. We've got plenty of other top sets that I'm trying to complete. So despite me backing away from that challenge, I do offer that challenge to you if you want an affordable, fun, cool set loaded down with some really incredible rookies and great stars. 86 Donruss is an outstanding one. But if you didn't listen to that podcast or you were only half paying attention, I did lay out for you the roadmap for our next few shows. So 2 weeks from today, that will be Friday, September the 25th, we will have a podcast that is going to go back to 1961. We're going to revisit the 61 top set, in part from a listener who challenged us to kind of take a look at it beyond aesthetics. There's a whole lot more to it, and I agree. And it's been about 3 years since we originally looked at 61 tops. I've had a few more added to my personal collection, so we'll dive into that. So look for that September 25th. And then afterwards, scheduled, we've got some interesting sets to take a look at. We will take a look at the 1993 Classic Best Minor League cards. When something so good and smart and organic as minor league baseball cards, like every other baseball card in the early 1990s, just blew up to bloviated proportions, and Classic Best was at fault for that. But there is a good reason why you perhaps may want to buy some on the cheap on eBay. And then we've got a unique show after that. We're going to look at two very unique products. The 1987 Donruss Pop-Up All-Star cards, which were a neat little novelty even when I was a kid. And I still remember the one that I had. It was Cal Ripken Jr. popping up with the Houston Astrodome behind him as a backdrop. So we'll take a look at that, as well as the very unique creation that Topps had back in 1979, All-Star Rappers. And no, I'm not talking about like Jay-Z or, you know, if it's 1979, we're talking like Melly Mel or, you know, somebody like that. No. When we're talking All-Star Rappers, it's W-R-A-P-P-E-R-S. So my apologies to Grandmaster Flash. But Topps had this great idea of producing their Bazooka Joe bubblegum, which of course was made by the Topps Chewing Gum Company. And rather than wrapping the gum in your standard kind of silly Bazooka Joe comics, they had All-Star Baseball comics. So we're going to open up, I believe I've got four pieces of this wretched stale gum from 1979, and we're going to take a look at a brilliant marketing campaign that just never took off. So that's what's coming up on future shows. You're always welcome to comment about our programs on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. Also, always appreciate feedback via any kind of feedback device on the platform you listen to. So especially Apple Podcast or whatever device you're listening on, whatever platform you're listening on, if you're given a chance to review the program, go ahead and do it. Good reviews are always appreciated. Bad reviews will be mocked. And we certainly appreciate, again, any 2 cents that you can offer up. And if you would, speaking of offering up a few cents. If you would like to make a donation to Wax Ecstatic, you could do so in one of two ways. A cash donation, always appreciated, even small amounts, even $5 goes a long way with this program. You can donate at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Or you can make a cardboard donation. I've received quite a few of those. I just ask you, please email me ahead of time. Matt Salmon says, that's S-E-Z, M-A-T-T-S-A-M-M-O-N-S-E-Z @gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking about, if it's something that we can use for the show or if it's something that we can package along with other cards that we send off to our good friends at Commons for Kids. Then we will arrange for shipping and payments and stuff like that. So again, either way, whether it's cash or cardboard, it is appreciated as always. We certainly appreciate all donations and all thoughts and helping hands that we get with this program. We've been able to keep it going strong with a slight hiatus, been able to keep it going strong for 4 years now. And we would certainly like to keep doing that for many years to come. Now, let's talk a little bit about the 1982 Topps MVP series with Kmart. And I want to dive right into this because there are so many layers to this onion that we've got to address them. And let me start off with just the general set. If you watched our Wax Ecstatic pack break, which we posted on YouTube yesterday, you will notice that the much maligned 82 Topps Kmart MVP series set still actually looks good many years from its initial release. But you will also notice that I got a little sloppy. Yes, I had shoddy show prep. You have to say that real careful. It's like shih tzu. You got to be very, very careful about saying that. Shoddy shih tzu show prep. Ooh, yeah, you got to be careful. Say that five times real fast. Shoddy shih tzu show prep. No, I won't. But as somebody who's been in the broadcasting business for 25 years now, I pride myself on show prep. And what show prep is what it sounds like. It's just preparing yourself for whatever you're going to talk about on radio, on television, or in this case, like a podcast. It's always just having done your homework, having your notes ready, just ready to dive right into whatever you're talking about it. So I normally have my act together, especially with this show. And the fact that you have a product here that I grew up with and a topic that I'm very passionate about, it's easy to do the show prep for the show. So you would think, talking about a card set that I've had in my hands for well over 30 years, you'd think that'd be easy, right?
Well, no, Mr. Salmon.
Yeah, I actually, you know, went into my storage bins and I pulled out this set, which is not in its original box. I've had it sitting in one of those plastic team bags for a long time. And I opened it up and I knew some of these cards were beat up. And I'll tell you how I ended up getting them. But as I'm looking at them, I'm like, oh, crap. I'm missing some. I never thought of that. Like I've had these forever and it never dawned on me. I'm missing a few cards here. In fact, from this 44 card set, I'm missing 8 cards. So I feel shame, like Denny Lemieux would say, send me to the penalty box, 2 minutes for shoddy show prep. And I apologize because, again, I pride myself on this. It's going to force me to actually buy one of these sets from eBay just so I can say I actually have it. But I am missing a few cards here, so I do apologize. But I think if you watched the video, you got the general gist of what the 82 Topps Kmart MVP series set was all about. Now, the basics of the set is so basic. It's beautiful. Topps and Kmart decided to co-op on a set release. Now, this was nothing new for Topps. Topps typically, especially in the late 1970s, would team up with big name brands to issue out, you know, different sets of baseball cards throughout each season. Most notably, Coca-Cola also, especially in the 1970s, Burger King. And a regional release, speaking of Coca-Cola, and I'm wondering if they had some kind of control over this. Also, the Squirt soda. Squirt was kind of a citrus soda, kind of like Sundrop. Squirt was more of a regional soda, so it was, maybe you couldn't get it in certain parts of the country. But, you know, you had these major brand alignments here. And I think Topps also had Hostess. You know, I mean, there were so many cross brands. It was perfect sense for not just Topps, but also the major brand. As baseball cards starting in the late 1970s were starting to grow into a major hobby, all of a sudden people were affixing values to these cards. So this was the early days, way before the junk wax era, where more and more kids in particular started buying baseball cards. And Topps would co-op with these brands. It would introduce cards maybe to a sector that never really thought of buying them. It was a neat thing to get into your Burger King kids meal or with that, you know, 6-bottle package of Coca-Cola at your grocery store. And it was a fun thing to pull from these various packages. And it also gave Topps a distinctive competitive advantage. Remember, all throughout the mid to late 70s, Topps is in a court battle with Fleer, eventually Fleer getting the right to produce their own baseball cards that were pushed behind by or Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association. So the officially licensed products that Topps had that monopoly on for many years, Fleer and, of course, Donruss would eventually be able to break down that gate starting in 1981. So Topps was, of course, very aware of this. So in order to continue to grow its footprint across North America as the real one, as, of course, they would be known with their ad campaign for many, many years, by, you know, co-opting with Coca-Cola and Burger King and all these other companies to get more and more Topps logo product out there, it was a brilliant strike for Topps here because it just increased their market visibility while Fleer and Donruss had to start almost from the very bottom. So this was nothing new. What was new, though, was that as opposed to being a food product like Coca-Cola or Squirt or a food location such as Burger King, this was, to my recollection, the first co-op between Topps and a retailer. Again, very, very smart strategy here. And again, in 1982, so now this is year two of the all-out battle for baseball card supremacy with Topps leading the way and Fleer and Donruss trying to make up ground quickly, striking a deal with what was then the number one suburban retailer in America was absolutely brilliant. And Topps and Kmart teamed up with this set where, in honoring Kmart's 20th anniversary, Topps was going to honor the most valuable players from both the National League and American League since 1962. Now, this did create some problems. Notably, you would have an odd number of cards because you had co-MVPs in 1979 in the National League with Keith Hernandez and Willie Stargell. So that would create, from 1962 to 1981, 41 cards. Well, Topps would print cards in sheets of 11 cards in a row. So you didn't want dead space on the last row of cards. You also didn't want to have double prints. You didn't want to have everything just thrown out of whack because of those three extra spaces, if you will. So Topps decided to create some highlights from the past 20 years. So you had highlights cards featuring highlights from Don Drysdale's career, Hank Aaron, as well as Pete Rose. Okay, so we've got a nice even 44 cards, 44 divided by 11, 4 rows per set. Excellent, great, awesome. But there was another problem. Two of the MVPs did not have their own card for the year that they won the award. Case in point, your 1962 National League MVP, Maury Wills, was not even featured in the 1962 set. And your 1975 American League MVP, Fred Lynn, well, he was in the set, but he didn't have his own card. He was one of the four faces on a rookie outfielder's card. You know what we talked about, the multi-panel Andrew Ridgely rookie cards that were popular with Topps in the 1970s. And as we did an entire podcast about it, several years before and several years after. So Topps had to create brand new cards to showcase on this brand new set. So if you've ever wanted a 62 Topps Maury Wills card, the only way you can get it is by purchasing a 1982 Topps Kmart MVP Series set. And the same thing with Fred Lynn. Basically, they took the headshot that they used for the Lynn rookie card and they dug it up in the archives and just kind of, you know, made a fake 75 Topps card with just Fred Lynn himself. So Topps was able to get over that hurdle. They came up with a very clever price point, $2.97. Hey, give us $3. We won't just give you our 2 cents. We'll give you three. That's Kmart value right there. So, of course, with thousands of Kmart stores around the United States back in 1982, this was incredible product placement. Not only could Topps make sure that their usual base set packs were available on Kmart shelves, but right next to it, you could get a complete 44-card set featuring 44 of the best players. Well, not necessarily 44 players because there were some multiple winners, but you get the idea. Featuring some of the best players from the previous 20 years of Major League Baseball for less than $3. For just a portion of your allowance, you mowed the neighbor's yard for $5. Guess what? You get to keep $2, which you can then spend getting the icy with the baseball team of your choice on the cup. Remember those? Oh, I mean, I've always liked icy. I mean, it's frozen sugar water. What's not to like about it, unless you're diabetic? But remember those baseball cups that they had? It wasn't just the usual wax paper cups that you got the icy in. It was the hard plastic ones. And it was always a treat when you would buy that large icy to see which cup the clerk behind the counter just randomly selected and gave you. Or if you had the cool clerk behind the counter, you could say, yes, could I have this team cup? And he or she would actually go shuffling through the stack of cups to find one for you. That was very nice of them. But those were some good quality cups too. I remember my family, we must have had like 10 of them that, you know, we used over and over again for years in our house. Boy, talk about dishwasher safe. Those baseball team logos and hats or, you know, warm-up jackets that they featured on the cups, they didn't wash away easily. So you could save money. You could spend, you know, that extra cash left over from your allowance elsewhere in Kmart. And like I said, it really helped expand Topps' footprint and dominance in one of the top retailers in America. It was a brilliant plan. The problem was, because there were thousands of Kmart stores, and because Kmart wanted to make sure that they were also able to distribute product with their name all over. So if you bought one of these, you were always promoting Kmart every time you were sharing these with your friends. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of sets were created. So that causes the usual free market economy problem here, where the supply far outweighs the demand. Now, that's not to say that the 82 Topps Kmart MVP Series cards weren't popular. If you were a kid back then, they were pretty cool. But the problem was you had tons of these just sitting in warehouses and Kmarts all across America. And what would Kmart do if they needed to move a product? Well, they would very quickly mark it down. And if you've ever gone to a Kmart, you've seen this. And this is back in the days when they had to put price stickers on everything. If you went into a Kmart where they were marking things down, you'd see like 8 different price stickers on it as they continue to just mark it down, mark it down, mark it down, mark it down until it finally got out of the door. So from $2.97 for a set, it would get marked down 2 for $3, and then maybe 3 for $3. Or if they were just trying to totally clear it out, they put it in the bargain bin in for like 75 cents or something like that. So that automatically drove down the value of the set, because for collectors, having something from 1982, 3 or 4 years later, is kind of cool. For a retailer, having something that is clearly marked 1982 on the shelf when it's 1984 is not a good thing. So it constantly got marked down, marked down, marked down, moved to the clearance aisles and bins, and then a lot of them just sat again in warehouses and just kind of flooded the market, which is rather appropriate when you're talking about baseball cards in general. So the set is maligned because, first of all, it's tagged with Kmart, and Kmart's just not a cool brand, and also because there's just tons of it out there. Now, what that does today is, if you've always wanted something from your childhood, getting a Kmart MVP series set from 1982 is not going to cost you that much, quite literally just a few dollars if you're including shipping and handling. So that's a good thing. It's not often that you can find baseball cards from 1982 for so cheap. So if you kind of look at it that way, it's a pretty good value. But I want to take a look at the value of the set from more of an emotional value. And that is why I go back to say that this was a very influential set for collectors. Because if you're my age, plus or minus a few years, let's say you're in your 40s, let's say, that means in 1982, you were a young lad, anywhere from, say, 5 years old, that's how old I was in 1982, to maybe, 11 or 12 years old. You're right in the wheelhouse of kids coming into the hobby. And whether you bought this yourself or somebody bought it for you, or you just came across it somewhere, you may not know it, but this was extremely influential in crafting how you saw the game and how you saw the hobby. Let's go back to 1982, shall we? How many channels did you have on your television set? More than likely, minimum of 3. 6 or 7 if you had the antenna pointed in the right direction for the UHF channels. Or if Dad got a pretty good bonus that year, maybe you ventured into cable television. And I recall getting cable TV installed in my house around 1982, 83. How many channels did you have back then? Like 30? there weren't that many. So access to information was very limited. In fact, your television may still have been a black and white set. Yeah, we actually had a small black and white set. That was our second set. But we had a small black and white set in our house up until like 84, 85. Let's also go back to how we got our information beyond television. Your radio was limited to AM and FM. That was all. Chances are you had actually more AM music stations than FM in 1982. And when it came to other information, you had to read it from something that you held in your hand. No, not your iPhone. Boy, we've got the world's library in our pockets now. No, in 1982, it was your newspaper. It was your magazine. It was the library book that you got, the textbook that you had at school. That was it. Yes, once again, I am walking in the Valley of the Dinosaurs. I'm explaining the world pre-internet. If you ever try to do that to somebody under 30, man, if you want to feel old, try explaining life before the internet to somebody under 30. You will feel like you're 80 in a heartbeat. I actually had to go through index cards at the library to find a book. Granddad, what's a book? You used to hold it and turn pages. And then you had to bring it back. So kind of like Netflix, you would just change the channel. No, damn it, you got in your car and drove there. You had to leave the house? That's impossible. What? Yes, life before the internet, if you wanted to know who was the MVP in Major League Baseball in 1962 for the American League and National Leagues, you either had to go to the library and find the Bill James Encyclopedia of Baseball, or maybe they were listed in the Sporting News baseball preview every spring. Or maybe you were lucky and you had somebody in your family who was a baseball fanatic and who handed down the story of those great players from 1962, Mickey Mantle and Maury Wills. Or for $2.97, you had the answer in that nice little cardboard box that you bought at Kmart with all the MVPs, American League and National League, right there. So not only were you educated on who the best players were for each individual year, but you were also educated on what baseball cards looked like back then. Again, unless you had some kind of reference material or a subscription to Beckett Baseball Card Monthly, you had no idea what a lot of these cards looked like. And certainly as a child, you couldn't afford any of them. Can you imagine trying to buy a 62 Mantle, even in 1982, that was still valued at a few hundred bucks? You didn't have that as a kid. And you'd probably never see one of those cards in person at a card show or a card shop, at least unless you were tall enough to look over the glass case. So it was very instrumental in showing us how the Topps baseball card evolved from 1962 to 1981. Incredible how you could hold in your hand not the actual 65 Willie Mays or 73 Reggie Jackson, but you could hold one that was kind of sort of the real thing. Now, maybe you were lucky if you were collecting, maybe you did have that 81 Mike Schmidt or that 80 George Brett, but you more than likely didn't have any of the cards prior to, say, 1979 or 78. So it introduced a lot of collectors to the hobby as we would know it, and it introduced us to the sport. It helped us provide more information of how the game also evolved from 1962 through 1981. And again, in a very affordable and portable fashion. So my first introduction to the set actually came in the late 1980s. I didn't buy it. My older brother, Mike, was somewhat interested in baseball cards when he was young. So when he was around, I'd say 7 or 8 years old, he must have bought a few packs here or there, because I know in a metal lunchbox, remember those? A metal lunchbox featuring all of the NFL helmet designs from roughly 1977, now it's a collector's item. I don't know where it is today. But anyways, that's where my brother held his baseball cards. And he had a few football cards too, but it was mostly baseball. Now, my brother Mike, God bless him, he's a great guy, but he just wasn't a big baseball nerd or a baseball card nerd like I am. He was the Star Trek nerd in the family. And he didn't really care much about the cards. So he had maybe, I don't know, 300, 400 cards stretching from 1980 through, I'd say, 83, just sitting in this lunchbox. And some of them were your standard Topps baseball cards. Some of them were Topps football cards. There were also a small set of Fleer football cards, looking back at previous Super Bowls, which was kind of neat. And there was this Kmart set. So when I got interested in baseball cards, I went back to this lunchbox, which I knew years before had existed, and I had thumbed through these cards without much thought to them. So, of course, once I got interested in the cards, I went back to see, were there any good ones? There were a few. They were a little beat up, but certainly nothing of the 83 Wade Boggs or 82 Cal Ripken kind. There was an 82 Ozzie Smith. Yeah, there were some decent players in there, 81 Lou Whitaker. But I went through this stack of cards, and here I find the Kmart cards. And I was transfixed with these for the reasons I just explained. You know, this was my first hands-on introduction to baseball cards and players from the 1960s and 1970s. So it very quickly ended up in my card collection. And I'll be honest, Mike, I took all your cards. Sorry. You know, they might be worth 10 bucks. You know, I'll give it to you, what, Thanksgiving? Maybe that's the next time we run into each other. But, you know, I took all these cards and, you know, eventually absorbed them into my collection. But I always had a soft spot for the Kmart cards, even though as time went on, I realized very quickly that these were not very valuable and they were not very popular. But again, they were very influential. And I think a lot of collectors are seeing that where, hey, you're probably going to pay more for shipping than the actual pack of cards. But it's a fun throwback to your childhood. And anything that's a fun throwback to your childhood, I think it's a good thing to kind of either look back at or reminisce on, or in this case, you can actually hold it in your hands. It's tangible. So if you're interested in the 82 Topps Kmart MVP series, you can buy sets online, not just eBay, Amazon. There's a lot of collectors who have them. And a lot of them, like I said, you will probably pay $5 for the set and $6.95 for the shipping. But for a small drop in the bucket to your normal baseball card purchasing habits, you can probably get this set pretty quickly, pretty easily. And again, it's affordable. And you're not going to put these cards in plastic holders. They're not going to go in the sheets. They're certainly not going to be sent off to BBCE or PSA, although I've seen some people do it. I don't know why. But this is a fun little subset that you could just kind of store away. Even use it as a stuffer, a filler in some of your boxes. And you can still go back and flip through them and reminisce not just about the great baseball players, but the great baseball cards that they appeared on, as well as your childhood memories about them. Now, real quickly, I want to go through the kind of the parallels between Kmart and Walmart and the baseball card hobby, because I do think this is worthy of a few minutes. Kmart was celebrating its 20th anniversary in 1982, and the Kmart store actually started from S.S. Kresge. And Kresge's was a department store that was born in the great era of department stores. Of course, talking, you know, around the turn of the century, where you had JCPenney and you had Sears and Montgomery Ward. You know, you can think of all of the, you know, Woolworths. You can think of all the big brand name stores, Moss Brothers, that came out around 1900. And Kresge's was one of the many of them. But Kresge was actually very wise to not just stick with the downtown department store concept. As more and more Americans after World War II started moving out to the suburbs, well, the stores had to move out there as well. At first, the Americans would drive back into downtown to make those once a month or every now and then pilgrimage to the old anchor downtown department store. But after a while, Americans got a little tired of going back and forth, especially as many downtown cores were starting to become derelict throughout the years. So you had to bring the stores to the suburbs. Well, of course, you had the shopping mall, and that is the indoor air-conditioned shopping mall that you know, is now dealing with its own demise these days. But back in, starting really in the late 1950s, the indoor air-conditioned shopping mall was a very popular destination and a hallmark of the new suburbia spread that was going on in America. But like I was saying earlier, not everybody had the good fortune of being within a close drive of said downtown department store or big shopping mall. So what you had was the shopping center or the shopping complex. Now, this again popped up starting in the late 1950s when grocery stores were starting to anchor these. And as the suburbs started to spread and grow even more and more people came out there, well, not only did you need to have an anchor grocery store at one end of these shopping plazas, you needed a department store. And that is where Kresge would move in. But rather than call it Kresge, it was called Kmart. Of course, Kresge Mart, basically. And in January of 1962, the first Kmart opened. Now, what's interesting is, just a few months later, July of 1962, the first Walmart opened, of course, named after its founder, Sam Walton. Now, Sam Walton was originally a store owner. In fact, he operated a JCPenney starting in the late 1940s, and he would own other stores, other department chains. But he thought that there was a better, more efficient way of reaching a certain subset of the population, not just the rich people that were moving out to the suburbs, but really just the general population, and thus created the low price warrior in Walmart. And Walmart was a rather unique entity that pretty much dominated throughout the Southeast. But still, Kmart was a national name. Yes, it started in California, very quickly popped up all throughout North America, while Walmart throughout the 60s and 70s was pretty much relegated to some more lower income areas throughout the South and the Southeast. So by 1982, Kmart is just riding high. And you can look at the hobby as well. Think about it. So I mentioned that Kresge is actually started around the turn of the century. Sam Walton, who started his ownership of stores with a JCPenney, that also started around the turn of the century. Baseball cards, yeah, started around the turn of the century. We know there are some from the, you know, late 1800s, and you know, they picked up steam in the early 1900s. And baseball cards didn't become what we know of them today until post-World War II. Same thing with shopping centers, suburban shopping malls, and the suburban department stores such as Kmart and Walmart. And the others that were just like it, Zayre's comes to mind, Gafers is another one. There were all sorts of brand names depending on where you lived. And throughout the 1960s and 1970s and into the 1980s, the suburban shopping complexes became more and more popular, much like baseball cards became more and more popular. And they became more and more plentiful, just like baseball cards exploded in the early 80s, thanks to Fleer and Donruss coming along. Well, Walmart started getting bigger. They started to go nationwide. You started having one chain buying out the other to, you know, get lots and lots bigger. And, you know, like I said, you had the Zayre's getting bought out by Ames. Ames was a Midwestern shopping magnet that gobbled up one chain to try to compete with the others. And, you know, it's something that is rather unique as you go through the 1980s and you have this war of you know, suburban shopping complexes, you know, growing up. You had this war between all these baseball card companies. Well, in 1990, that is when Kmart got a little too fat and happy. They were quite content with where they were. Hey, why change? We're the best. We're number one. We got our cute little blue light specials. Well, while they were doing that, Walmart was reinventing their stores behind the scenes. They were creating a whole new digital inventory system. While Kmart had the outdated 1970s and 1980s cash registers and UPC code readers, and were pretty much independent from one another, one store didn't really talk to the other, Walmart was creating the state-of-the-art network where they could not only link up one store to the other, but one store could tell the other store how much product they had. The stores could go back to a regional warehouse, which could report back to, you know, the main office in Arkansas about, you know, what's been bought, what's been sold, where more supplies need to be. Very ingenious, forward-thinking operations here by Sam Walton and company. So Kmart got too big and fat. Walmart gets nimble and progressive. And by 1990, Walmart moves past Kmart as the number one retailer. Now, why is 1990 such a good parallel to the Kmart and Walmart war? Well, think of the war of the baseball cards. You had Topps, you had Fleer, you had Donruss, you had Score, you had Upper Deck, you had Bowman, and everyone who got fat and happy, who was quite content with their sets, they started getting left behind. So it's the companies that innovated, that were nimble, that were progressive, that made the inroads. Most notably, Topps Stadium Club. And then you also had Upper Deck raising the bar once again. And then Fleer put out some great Ultra products. Donruss had the Leaf products. So the main brands, the base sets, started peeling off as time went on. And it was the premium ones that survived. Well, once you got through the premium stage, then it was the premium sets that were able to conquer and divide. And what I mean by that was creating more subsets and refractor cards and limited edition cards, and basically just one company outdoing the other, to where eventually, yes, the market collapsed and the strongest survived. It was ultimately Topps and Fleer and Upper Deck. And eventually Topps signs the exclusivity deal with Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association in 2005, thus eliminating the competition, but keeping the hobby from going off its tracks again. So that also aligns rather nicely with the suburban retail picture as well. Think about it. You had Walmart overtaking Kmart, and after that, a lot of the old school stores started folding up. Woolworths went away. McCrory's went away. Moss Brothers went away. Gafers went away. And eventually, Kmart and Sears had to merge, creating America's largest retailer of pure crap. It was a terrible thing. You know, they both had to do it to survive. But, you know, looking at these once great brands now just dying on the scrap heap of retailers, I was amazed to find out that Kmart was technically still in business, and I'm sure in some form or fashion they will be for a while. But it's only a matter of time before Sears and Kmart go away. And much like Walmart was smart enough to change over the years to not only bypass Kmart, but to remain strong, they still have to. They've got to be innovative because, well, looky here. Here comes e-commerce led by Amazon, and Amazon's eating everybody's lunch. So, you know, Walmart is creating its own, you know, counter to Amazon Prime. And it's going to go back and forth between Amazon and Walmart for many years. Meanwhile, you still have players like Target is going to be in there, and there's going to be, you know, not necessarily a mega store, but, you know, IKEA, I can think of, you know, specializing in furniture. A lot of these big box stores, though, which, you know, kind of grew from the suburban shopping malls, your innocent little Walmart and your Zares and your Kmarts grew into these ginormous stores. Well, they're going away too. Like, seriously, how long are we going to have Best Buy around? How long are we going to have some of these other big chain stores? You know, Circuit City went bye-bye. H.H. Gregg went bye-bye, thinking of electronics retailers. So, you know, the companies that can't be nimble are going to die on the vine. And you're seeing that especially with COVID now. They're all, you know, shriveling up here. JCPenney filing for bankruptcy. Lord & Taylor, all of these, you know, mega stores are just going to roll up and blow away in the wind. So I think that's actually rather appropriate with the baseball card industry as well. Yes, Topps is the only officially licensed product of Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association, but you still have some decent, I'm not a big fan of it, but some decent stuff coming from the Panini Group, you know, resurrecting the Donruss brand, even if it isn't officially licensed. And all right, so Topps has every other brand name under the umbrella. They've got Bowman, they've got Turkey Red, they've got Opening Day, they've got all of these, you know, brands under their own control now. But even they have to innovate. You know, the Topps Now, the Topps reworked baseball cards, the virtual cards that you're seeing, they have to keep thinking of how to move the ball forward, because they're going to see, all right, maybe it's not another baseball card company that overtakes us, but some other form of entertainment. That has to keep the Topps people up late at night. Okay, how do we work in a world where the competition isn't Fleer and Donruss and Upper Deck anymore? The competition is PlayStation and Xbox and virtual reality and Netflix and Amazon Prime and YouTube TV. This is where kids are getting their entertainment these days. How do we keep people engaged in our business? So I think it's appropriate that we look at this Topps set from 1982, not just because it's a real neat throwback to our childhood, but also because there's a lesson here where if you're not careful, if you're too fat and happy, if you're too satisfied with being number one, you're gonna get run over eventually. It happened to Kmart starting in 1990. It almost happened in the baseball card industry around 1990. And it's something that certainly keeps card companies moving these days because, again, there are so many different entertainment options that you've got to fight to keep not only your brand out there and keep people aware that you're creating new and innovating stuff, but to keep yourself relevant too. And that's something that Kmart didn't do to Walmart. That's something that Topps and others were able to adjust to when they faced competition 30 years ago and as they're facing competition now. So if you're a student of business and management, and especially competition in those two fields, this is a pretty good lesson. In 1982, Kmart was on top of the world. Screw Walmart. Screw Zaire. Screw Ames. We're Kmart, damn it. We've got icy cups over here. We've got a restaurant in the back of the store. We've got America's favorite knockoff brand shoes. Lord knows I wore a lot of those to school. You know what? The blue light special, it can only take you so far. You have to think forward. You can't always lean backwards. In 1982, Kmart was leaning backwards. Everybody else was leaning forwards. And now Kmart is kind of a punchline to, you know, the shoddy strip mall store that we used to go to when we were kids. All right, let's take a look at the four players that I selected from the truncated 1982 Topps Kmart MVP set here. Yeah, I normally would have had 41 to choose from, but missing a few. But I decided, you know, we've all heard of the stories of Mickey Mantle and Reggie Jackson and Mike Schmidt. So figured let's dive a little deeper, shall we? And I selected a couple names that you're probably well aware of, but maybe a couple players that you don't really know their whole story. And we're going to start with the 1963 American League MVP, the late Elston Howard. Now, he was a longtime catcher and utility man, and as you'll discover why, he was a utility player not by choice, but because the Yankees, who he played much of his career with, of course, had Yogi Berra behind the plate. And even though Yogi was getting older throughout the years there, he was still pretty solid of a catcher. Elston Howard couldn't really work his way in to the lineup too often. But Elston Gene Howard, born in February 1929, a native of the St. Louis, Missouri area. He was a standout athlete at Vashon High School, and he was an incredible football player, was offered scholarships to several big schools, including Michigan and Michigan State, also Illinois, but he decided to sign with the Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro League, and Buck O'Neill, the legendary Buck O'Neill, was the manager of the team, and he was signed on for $500 a month. Now, what's interesting is this was in 1948. And even though Jackie Robinson had broken the color barrier in Major League Baseball, and certainly the Brooklyn Dodgers were the team that were kind of leading the way in bringing up young, prospects, Black American prospects. Of course, they would eventually bring up Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb and many others along the way. But even though more Black players were starting to get into the major league system, it's an interesting choice that Howard decided to go through the Negro Leagues. And he would play for Kansas City for 3 years and was even a roommate with Ernie Banks. Now, he does eventually sign with the Yankees in July of 1950, picked up from Kansas City along with Frank Barnes, and assigned to the Muskegon Clippers. Now, he had to go away from minor league baseball for a couple of years in the Army, serving during the Korean War in 1951 and 52. He comes back to Kansas City in 1953. No, not the Monarchs. He's in the Yankee system, playing for their AAA club, the Kansas City Blues. And he gets an invite to spring training in 1954. Now, again, even though he was an outfielder at the time with Kansas City, the Yankees decide to convert him into a catcher to take advantage of that great arm of his. But Yogi Berra has no designs to leave his position behind home plate. And even though it's 1954, believe it or not, the Yankees still have not had an African-American player in the lineup during the regular season. So in 1954, he goes back to AAA. Now, the Yankees farm club at that time, the Toronto Maple Leafs. He led the league in triples, had 22 home runs, batted .330, and was the MVP of the International League. So the Yankees really feel like, all right, we've got to work on this guy as a catcher. So they continue to develop him. Finally gets a call up in 1955, April 14th, 1955, makes his major league debut, comes in as an outfielder, defensive replacement in the sixth inning, and in his first plate appearance of the day, has a base hit, and he would be the first African-American to play for the Yankees. Yes, 1955, when the Yankees finally got around to it. Not as bad as the Red Sox and Pumpsy Green, but still, the Yankees could have done a lot better considering their crosstown rivals. The Dodgers were able to do that 8 years before. But I digress. It was not easy for Howard. In fact, Casey Stengel, the manager for the Yankees, nicknamed him 8-Ball, which is not exactly politically correct or racially sensitive. So I'm sure Casey's looking at it as a kind of a joke, but you couldn't do that these days. You definitely could not do it. Now, because Yogi Berra wasn't moving behind home plate, and also the Yankees had some, pretty decent outfielders, you know, guys named Mickey Mantle and Hank Bauer, also, some pretty good utility parts as well. He didn't get a ton of time. He appeared in 97 games in the 1955 season and did have some shining moments in the 1955 World Series against the Dodgers, although unfortunately, he was the final out. In Game 7, a grounder to shortstop Pee Wee Reese, which tossed over to Gil Hodges for the 6-3 ground out to end the series. Now, even though Howard didn't exactly have a hallmark 55 World Series, he did hit a home run in the lone game that he appeared in 1956. That's when the Yankees defeated the Dodgers in 7 games. He would also have a stellar series in 1957, where the Yankees lost to the Milwaukee Braves in 7 games. But when the Yankees and Braves met again in 1958, he also had some stellar defensive plays, even though he was not known as the fastest guy on the team. He had very good outfield acumen and also a very powerful arm too, was able to surprise quite a few Braves hitters by doubling them off in what would seem to be routine plays. He was able to get to the play at the right time and get the ball to the right spot quickly enough. He also, in Game 7 of the 58 World Series, had a two-out RBI single, which gave the Yankees a 3-2 lead, and it would turn out to be the game-winning RBI, as the Yankees would win that game 6-2. So, despite his heroics, does not win World Series MVP honors. Bob Turley picks that up. And by 1959, Howard, still not catching, is getting moved over to first base, and that is where he would play throughout the 1959 season. Was an all-star member in 1957, and that would be the first of 9 consecutive years that he would play in the Midsummer Classic, including both of the 1961 All-Star games. Now, finally, he takes over behind the plate as Berra, who is getting much older, but is still usable. Berra gets moved out to the outfield, and Elston Howard's behind the plate. Unfortunately, at the losing end of a lengthy World Series again, 1960, Bill Mazeroski with the game-winning home run bottom of the ninth for the Pirates to defeat the Yankees. And still Elston Howard, despite being on the losing end of that equation, would be part of the winning team again the following year, 1961, when the Yankees defeated the Cincinnati Reds. Also in 1962, the Yankees defeating the Giants in seven games, although his postseason heroics were not as evident at this point in time. He was not hitting very well in the 62 series. Now, as for that MVP season in 1963, batting .287, a .528 slugging percentage, 28 home runs, 85 RBI, and he won his first Gold Glove Award. Unfortunately, the Yankees losing to the Dodgers that year as they would get swept aside there. And then, of course, the Yankees again losing to the Cardinals in 1964. So some ups and downs here, and we'll conclude that with his final World Series appearance in 1967 in just a moment. However, Elston Howard started dealing with some injuries and had to deal with a terrible elbow injury during the 1965 spring training, missed several weeks and got off to a very slow start. Now, he would continue to struggle throughout the next couple of seasons as he got a little older. And by 1967, the Yankees, who by then are collectively going downhill, have decided to move on from Elston Howard. August 3rd, 1967, they trade him to the Red Sox. What? For Pete Magrini and a player to be named later. That would be Ron Klumkowski. Now, Howard did not bat well with the Red Sox. However, defensively, he was a star behind the plate, was a key reason for the Red Sox staff to settle things down and have that tremendous summer of 67 World Series run, which they would lose the series to the St. Louis Cardinals in seven games. So that puts Elston Howard in a very unique club where he has the rather unfortunate distinction of playing for the most losing World Series teams. And that club is shared by Pee Wee Reese, ironically the man who he grounded out to in 1955. The difference is that Elston Howard, yes, he was on six World Series losing teams. He was also on six World Series winning teams. So it's not exactly like this guy was a case of bad luck. Reese, on the other hand, he was on six losers and only one winner. So the slight edge in that department should go to Reese. Now, after the 1968 season, Howard was released by the Boston Red Sox, thus ending his career with 1,471 hits, a .274 career batting average, and an outstanding fielding percentage as a catcher as a .993 and overall percentage .992. And I know some people aren't crazy about field percentages there, but for a guy who was not known for his speed, seemed to find himself in the right place at the right time. And again, his arm was very powerful and very accurate. Now, he would get back into the game as a coach with the Yankees, first base coach from 1969 to 1979. In fact, he was the first black coach in the American League. And he also had some very famous moments with the Yankees, most notably keeping Reggie Jackson from tearing Billy Martin's head off in the infamous Fenway Park confrontation in June of 1977. He would later become an administrative assistant with the Yankees. However, he was diagnosed with myocarditis and had to deal with heart conditions through much of his final years of life, and sadly passed away way, way too young at the age of 51 back in 1980. His number 32 has been retired by the Yankees. They did that in 1984. And he has a plaque at Monument Park in Yankee Stadium. Now, while Elston Howard did a lot of great breakthrough things, the first black player for the New York Yankees, the first black coach in the American League, the 1963 AL MVP, Gold Glove Award winner, like I said, nine consecutive All-Star appearances, He also has a lasting contribution to the game. If you've ever looked at the on-deck circle, you see the donut. Yeah, I know, it's kind of an exasperated Homer Simpson there. Donuts. No, the metal donut. Yes, the donut, the big metal heavy weighted ring. You see players put it on their bat. They swing it around. It helps build up a little muscle, makes the bat heavier. And then that way, when you go up to the plate, it feels lighter as you're swinging it. That was a creation of Elston Howard. So it caught on very quickly, the old fashioned way of, you know, making that bat feel heavy. And you've probably seen some old video clips of this. You would have players that they would take three or four bats and hold them at the same time and swing them around there. And then, you know, pick one from the bunch and use it. But by using the donut, players didn't have to haul out a whole lumber yard to get warmed up for their at-bats. Now, he also helped a couple of businessmen from New Jersey, Frank Hamilton and Vince Salvucci, make that bat weight, and he lent his name to the product. So the Elston Howard donut, one of the many breakthroughs that the late Elston Howard helped create, but again, leaves a lasting image in Major League Baseball. Now, while Elston Howard had a lot of touch points in his storied career, the next player that we're looking at is often overlooked simply because he didn't have that great of a career from start to finish. He was a very average hitter, a below average fielder, and he doesn't necessarily come to the top of mind when you talk about great Minnesota Twins. Now, you talk about great Minnesota Twins. First name, you're probably going to think of Kirby Puckett. And then you go through the history books and you go, okay, Kirby Puckett. You got Harmon Killebrew, Tony Oliva. Frank Viola, his early years. Jack Morris, that great stint, 1991, where he helped them win the World Series. You can come up with Ken Herbeck. You can come up with, all these other players from those times. But one player who had it all come together in one year, and that was pretty much it. He had a lengthy career, but it was pretty much just one year where it all came together, was the shortstop, Zolio Versalles. Zolio Versalles was the MVP for the American League in 1965. That was the one year where it all came together. And whether you credit Twins manager Billy Martin, or maybe you credit just everything coming together for the Twins in 1965, they would win the American League pennant that year and battle the Dodgers, take a clearly almost completely broken down Sandy Koufax to the limit, stretch that series to seven games. Whatever the reason is, Versalles had that one shining season. Now, as for his MVP season in 1965, led the American League in plate appearances, at-bats, runs scored, doubles, triples, extra base hits, total bases, had second place in assists, third in stolen bases, and he was a near unanimous winner in the MVP award voting. He received 19 of the 20 first place votes. The lone first place vote that didn't go to him went to his teammate, Tony Oliva. Now, he unfortunately also led the American League and had career highs in strikeouts and errors. He had 39 errors, so he continued to struggle out in the field, even though for one season he was fairly decent at the plate. But let's go back to the very beginning for Zolio Versalles, who, despite one season of just glory in 1965, really had a tremendous struggle to make it in the major leagues, and then a really tragic ending, not only to his career, but his life as well. Native of Havana, Cuba, had a tough time after getting signed by the Washington Senators in 1958. The reason why he had a tough time was he did not acclimate to America and the English language very well. In fact, he never learned the English language, was homesick for Cuba, and of course, Cuba going through the Castro Revolution back around this exact same time. So it was a very difficult climb for him as he was adjusting to life in America, adjusting to the English language, and then also adjusting to trying to play Major League Baseball. Now, he would, after getting signed in 1958 and working his way up through the Washington Senators system, He would make his major league debut August 1st, 1959, did not do very well, so he went back and forth between the minor leagues and the major leagues in 1959 and 1960. Now, once the Senators relocated to Minneapolis and were renamed the Twins, he would come up to the major leagues and would actually stick around, although he was a notable weak point, especially because of his defensive woes in the Twins lineup. Now, an interesting point of history here with Versailles, thanks in part to baseball cards, is his nickname of Zorro, as the 1961 Topps card for Versailles, card number 21, actually lists him as Zorro Versailles. So that's kind of how it stuck. You know, that was his kind of unofficial nickname with the team, and it became more of a public nickname after the printing of that baseball card. Like I said, a very average player throughout much of his career, did have that great 1965 season, got a healthy raise, actually got a $40,000 contract out of it, and naturally things started falling apart there. Hitting only .249 in 137 games in 1966. Continued to struggle, out in the field. And, basically by the end of the 1967 season, the Twins decide to move on, traded him to the LA Dodgers, along with Mudcat Grant, for Johnny Roseborough, Ron Peronoski, and Bob Miller. Now, the 1968 season with the Dodgers was an absolute disaster. Hit only .196, was exposed in the Major League Baseball draft, and of course, Buzzy Bavasi, formerly an executive with the Dodgers, who is now in San Diego, decides to draft him with the 10th selection. But Versailles never plays for the Padres, as he was sent to the Cleveland Indians to complete an earlier trade that sent Bill Davis, a first baseman, to San Diego. Now, his offensive numbers went up a little bit, appearing in 72 games with the Indians, but then his contract was purchased by the Washington Senators. So Versailles would become part of a very unique group, one of nine players to be a member of both Washington Senators teams, and he actually wore the Senators uniform. Now, he hit .267 for the Senators, was invited back for spring training in 1970, but released just prior to the 1970 season. So he plays 1 year for the Mexican League, and then gets purchased by the Atlanta Braves early in the 1972 season. Again, a pretty woeful season, hitting just .191 in 66 games. Gets released by the Braves, moves on to Japan with the Hiroshima Toyo Carp. And that would end his Major League Baseball career, a batting average of .242, also had just over 1,000 hits, 1,046 hits, and 84 stolen bases in 1,065 games. So really, not a ton of great numbers to brag about here, unfortunately. And things really got sad, afterwards. He dealt with a lot of injuries throughout the final few years, including a very bad back injury. He would have just some low man on the totem pole jobs after his major league career. Eventually had to foreclose his house, had to sell his trophies, his MVP trophy, his gold gloves, all-star rings, all had to be sold just to help him get by. He basically lived on Social Security and disability payments from the federal government, and also suffered two heart attacks, had to undergo stomach surgery, and just really had a terrible time of life for basically the last almost 20 years of his life here. Found dead in his home in Bloomington, Minnesota, June of 1995. Turns out he died from hardening of arteries. He left behind a wife, six daughters, and several grandchildren. Now, a little silver lining to the story, Versailles did get into the Twins Hall of Fame. Certainly Twins management and Twins fans remember that one shining season in 1965. Now, from one shining season in 1965 to a player who had numerous shining seasons, but who also had quite the attitude that did not ingratiate himself with several people along the way, most notably Whitey Herzog in St. Louis, of course, talking about Keith Hernandez. Now, Keith Hernandez was born just outside of San Francisco in October 1953. Shares a birth date with Mickey Mantle, which is why his various stops along the way, he had the number 7 as part of his uniform number. Wore number 37 with the Cardinals. When he went to the Mets, he changed it to number 17 because Casey Stengel had number 37. That number had been retired by then. So a nice little numerology story there about him. Now, he had a .296 career average, was a pretty patient hitter, but also an outstanding defenseman. You did not try to hit the ball to the right side of the field because Keith Hernandez was going to scoop it up one way or another. Now, he would, going back to his high school days, transfer to Cappuccino High School in San Bruno and actually sat out his senior year because he did not like his head coach. He butted heads with his head coach. So going into the 1971 Major League Baseball draft, he is seen as a little bit of a head case here. And it turns out that that really knocked him down quite a bit. He wasn't drafted until the 41st round, 783rd overall, by the St. Louis Cardinals. So after playing briefly at the College of San Mateo, he would get drafted by the Cardinals and would eventually get into their farm system, very quickly moving up through their system and making his major league debut at Candlestick Park. So being able to be a bit of a hometown hero, August 30th, 1974, went 1-for-2 with 2 walks. He also earned his first major league RBI with a go-ahead run in the, or with an RBI in the 9th inning. There we go. Now, following the 1974 season, the Cardinals part ways with former MVP Joe Torre, as they send him to the Mets for Tommy Moore and Ray Sadecki. So Keith Hernandez has first base pretty much locked down. Now, he would go on to become not only a star hitter, but also a Gold Glove winner. And as you could see going through this Topps Kmart MVP series, was the co-National League MVP, or the National League co-MVP winner, along with Pops, Willie Stargell, in Pittsburgh. And that would be the only time in Major League history that two players would receive the same number of points from the Baseball Writers Association of America for the sharing of that award. Now, he would average 300 pretty much every season, a member of the 1982 World Series champion St. Louis Cardinals, clobbered a home run in game 6 of that series, joining Daryl Porter as well in that series. He had 8 RBI during the 7-game World Series as well. But while this is going on, you've got all sorts of controversy brewing in Hernandez's life. First of all, his cocaine use. He was a rather avid user of cocaine in the early 1980s, was actually caught up in the Pittsburgh drug trials, which Peter Ueberroth, later the commissioner of baseball, would suspend several players, or the suspensions were reduced to time served, if you will, if they made some community adjustments in their lives. And Hernandez would say that, you know, by the time that he would join the Mets in 1983, that he had finished using cocaine. And part of it was because as a veteran player, he was expected to have a leadership role. So you'll have to take his word for that. But during the same time, and, you know, I remember infamously the Bill Cosby stand-up routine from the early 1980s. Not that Bill Cosby is certainly a good person to look up to, but there was a segment in that comedy scene where he's going through the effects that drugs have on people. And I remember him talking about cocaine, where, you know, people who use cocaine, they say it accentuates their personality. And Cosby says, well, what if you're an asshole? And apparently that's what happened with Keith Hernandez. Of course, at the same time, Whitey Herzog was not exactly the easiest manager to work with throughout the years. So there are some players who will praise Whitey Herzog and everything that he did. And there will be others who basically said this guy was off his rocker and nobody's really sure what his deal was. One thing for sure, though, was much like high school, Hernandez did not like his manager here. And of course, he couldn't sit out the season, but he was traded to the Mets for Neil Allen and Rick Owenby. You talk about just a dumping of a contract and a personality. That's exactly what happened there. And in fact, Herzog went as far to say that Hernandez was a cancer for the team. Yikes. Yeah. So here comes Keith Hernandez going from the defending world champions to a basement dweller in the Mets. And the Mets were building things up in 1983, but had a pretty putrid ending to the season, 68-94, finishing dead last in the National League East. But the Mets were greatly improved in 1984, going 90-72. And sure, there were youngsters that helped fuel that growth, but having Hernandez, you know, not only be a good bat, not only be a good defensive stalwart, not just at first base, but really the right side of the infield and outfield. Sometimes the Mets would have him be the cutoff man and they'd slide the second baseman over to first base. You know, because he was just so defensively smart here, they were able to turn the corner quickly, and Hernandez did develop into a leadership role. He was a leader in the sense that he was one of the more vocal players on the team. Well, of course, 1986 comes around, and we all know how the 1986 season works out for the Mets. Not just the acquisition of Keith Hernandez helping turn that team around, but Gary Carter, of course, in 1985, helping the Mets get over the top in that World Series. And Hernandez, of course, having a very big part in that, most notably in Game 7, as he was finally able to get some runs on the board for the Mets in their rally in the sixth inning with a two-run single. And he would also drive in a run later in the game to help the Mets win their second World Series. After the time with the Mets, which he continued to be very successful for in 1987 and 88, his playing time starts coming down, dealing with a lot of injuries late in the 1988 season, certainly 1989, appearing in just 75 games, hitting .233. After the season, the Mets don't renew his contract, so he becomes a free agent, signs with the Cleveland Indians, but really a whimper of a season for an outstanding career, appearing in only 45 games, batting .200, and he would retire at the end of the season. Now, Keith Hernandez, of course, is not retired from life. He has been a broadcaster with the Mets since 2006, more notably, an actor. Yes, part of a couple of legendary episodes of Seinfeld. Also a member of the Actors Guild for Law and Order. And of course, appearing alongside Walt Frazier for some of those comically bad Just for Men hair coloring spots from, what, about 15 or 20 years ago. He's been rejected. Yeah, remember that one? Interesting note about Keith Hernandez, because his dad was a big fan and friend of Stan Musial. In fact, his dad actually played ball with Musial when both men were in the Navy during World War II. Apparently, Keith's father took some pretty good notes from Stan Musial during those years and would actually use what he learned from Musial to pass along to Hernandez when he struggled at the plate. And of course, Hernandez would have crossed paths with Musial as in his time with St. Louis, but I thought that was very interesting that his dad would critique Hernandez's batting if he was in a slump, and would reach back into his pocket of hitting tips from Stan the Man. Last but not least, boy, talk about a throwback player, not necessarily because of what he did, but how he looked. We're talking about Roland Glenn Fingers, but we know Roland better as Raleigh Fingers, Steubenville, Ohio native, born in August of 1946. He actually just celebrated a birthday recently. He turned 74. Great story about Raleigh Fingers is when he was originally going to be signed by a Major League Baseball team, it was going to be the LA Dodgers. And the Dodgers offered him a signing bonus of $20,000 as he's finishing up a semester of Chaffee Junior College in Southern California. But he looks at the Dodgers
pitching rotation. He was actually a starter back then. And he's just like, okay, wait a minute. And by the way, let me put this into context here. This would have been happening in, let me see, 1965, I believe. 1964. So you look at the Dodgers rotation, 1964. All right, you've got Koufax, you got Drysdale, you've got some great arms in the system that were coming up pretty soon. And Raleigh Fingers is just like, I'm never going to play for the Dodgers. Why would I want to sign for them? So he instead takes a cut, a $13,000 signing bonus, to sign with the Kansas City Athletics. Clearly, the Athletics at that time had not quite had great arms at the major league level, although they certainly had a pipeline brewing. I think Catfish Hunter was probably the closest to playing in the major leagues at that time, but of course, later they would have Vida Blue and Blue Moon Odom and so many other great pitchers. So he would move into the Kansas City Athletics organization, very quickly moving up through their organization. However, getting a pretty severe scare in 1967 while playing for the Birmingham A's in AA, a line drive nailed him right in the face, broke his cheekbone, jaw, knocked out some teeth. He had to have his jaw wired shut for 5 weeks and then finally got back into action. But it didn't slow him down, as he was able to make it to Oakland pretty quickly, making his major league debut in 1968, and would, you know, occasionally go in and out of the lineup, but he got caught up in the logjam, ironically, of the starting rotation starting in 1970 and going into the 1971 season. So what he tried to avoid with the Dodgers, he ended up getting stuck with the A's. Well, his last start with the A's would be May 15th, 1971, and he's eventually moved to the bullpen, and he comes out of the bullpen in the following game that he appeared in, May 21st, 1971, and eventually had a pretty uneventful outing there. But over the course of the season, Dick Williams, the manager for the A's, says that he's going to be his closer. Now, remember, this is when the role of the closer is basically being defined, and the save statistic has just been created and being acknowledged by Major League Baseball here. So there was no design to have Raleigh Fingers as the designated closer for the Oakland Athletics. It just kind of happened that way. He got squeezed out of the rotation and eventually became the closer. And starting in 1972, he became a very dominant closer. Now, an interesting note about 1972, that is also when he started growing his classic handlebar mustache. Now, this was all part of an effort by the A's to get Reggie Jackson to shave his beard. He shows up at spring training with a full beard. Players don't like it. They all think that Charlie Finley is going to force Jackson to shave it. So rather than respond by like holding Jackson down and trying to shave him, which would have been a very terrible idea, everybody on the team starts growing a beard or a mustache. Well, Finley actually takes the opposite reaction. Instead of fining everybody or yelling at everybody, he actually sees this as a marketing ploy. And he tells the players, yeah, go ahead and grow your mustaches and beards. And they actually start getting bonuses. So in order to stand out from the rest of the crowd, Fingers would actually wax his mustache into that curly handlebar look that was a kind of status quo for many stereotypical ball players around the turn of the century. So he would become a dominant closer, of course, part of the Oakland Athletics World Series champions in 1972, 73, and 74. And he was involved in one of the most bizarre trades in Major League history. With the 1976 death of the reserve clause, Charlie Finley thinks, I'm not going to be able to afford all of these players who are going to become free agents. So he tried to sell everybody. What Charlie Finley made a huge mistake on is he tried to sell all of his star players all at once. So he tried to sell Fingers and Joe Rudy to Boston for $1 million each. He tried to sell Vida Blue to the Yankees for $1.5 million. And Bowie Kuhn, then the commissioner of baseball, pulled out the old not in the best interest of baseball rule. Finley sues Kuhn, benches Fingers and Blue, and Rudy says, well, they're not members of my team. They can't play. The A's riot, and they basically say, well, we're not going to play if you're not going to let them play. So finally, there was a truce between Finley and the team, and they were able to get on the field. However, there was never a truce between Finley and Kuhn, and here's poor Raleigh Fingers. And let's be honest, Joe Rudy and Vita Blue just kind of waiting out the rest of the 1976 season, wondering what their future would hold for them. Now, Blue would go on to sign as a free agent with the San Diego Padres, won the Rolaids Relief Man of the Year Award in 1977, 78, and 1980. And then he was part of another series of transactions that were, as Artie Johnson would say, very interesting. December 8th, 1980, the Padres trade Gene Tennis, Bob Shirley, and a player to be named later who would be Bob Guerin, along with Fingers, to the St. Louis Cardinals for Terry Kennedy, John Littlefield, Al Olmsted, Mike Phillips, Kim Seaman, Steve Swisher, and John Urrea. Suffice to say, didn't really pay off well for the Padres. Now, just a few days later, Fingers gets traded again, along with Ted Simmons and Pete Vukovich to the Brewers for Sixto Lizcano, Larry Sorensen, David Green, and Dave LaPointe. Now, he would go on to win the Rolaids Relief Man of the Year Award again in 1981, as well as, obviously, the MVP award and the American League Cy Young award. And he would appear in the 1982 World Series with the Brewers, who faced, ironically, the St. Louis Cardinals. Of course, the Cardinals would go on to win in seven games. Now, he would miss the 1983 season because of a back injury and played for several more appearances in 1984 and 1985 with the Brewers before getting released. Now, a couple of interesting stories about Fingers' career here. First of all, it almost got extended into the 1986 season when the Cincinnati Reds offered him a contract. Pete Rose, then the manager, notes that, you know, hey, you know, this guy can still throw the ball and can, you know, win us some ball games here. Why not offer him a deal? And the problem was, is the Reds, who were then owned by noted whack job and Nazi sympathizer Marge Schott, they had a clean cut rule. So players were not allowed to have beards or mustaches. You had to have trimmed hair. And reportedly, Fingers turned down the deal, telling Reds management, you tell Marge Schott to shave her dog and I'll shave my mustache. And I'm kind of surprised, considering some of the oddball eccentric, we'll say, things that Marge Schott did. I'm actually surprised that she didn't shave Schottsy just for the chance to get Raleigh Fingers to be on the team there. Raleigh Fingers was inducted into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame in 1982. An interesting connection between him and Keith Hernandez, other than briefly crossing paths with the St. Louis Cardinals during the winter of 1980, Raleigh Fingers' dad also was a close friend of Stan Musial. In fact, they roomed together in the Cardinals minor league system at one point in time. How weird is that? And of course, Raleigh Fingers still has that handlebar mustache today, something that started as an answer to Reggie Jackson's grotesque beard and a way to squeeze a few bucks out of Charlie Finley and also, you know, add an interesting identity to the swinging A's of the early 1970s, still carries it to this day. And all four of those players, those who are still with us and those who have passed on, still carry the note in Major League Baseball's history books as being MVP award winners, which, of course, you can experience with the 1982 Topps Kmart MVP set. 44 cards still available in plentiful numbers and relatively cheap. Again, you're not going to make any money off of this. This is not something that you need to go out and buy. But again, if you're kind of around my age, you're in your mid to late 40s, and you collected at a young age, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, you probably remember those sets. And I bet you'll enjoy going through those once again. So go ahead and buy one. It'll be a neat thing to have, neat thing to share with your kids. And like I said before, at the very least, that cardboard box with the 44 cards will act as a nice filler To take care of some gaps in your card boxes. Well, that'll do it for our look at the 1982 Topps Kmart MVP series. Much maligned, much looked down upon, but so influential to a lot of kids learning more about baseball, learning more about baseball cards in the pre-internet era. When Kmart was the place to be, they were sitting on top of the world all fat and happy. Oh, if they only knew what Sam Walton was cooking in the computer network that would revolutionize not only how Walmart operated, but also how many retail stores operated. But it was a little too late for Kmart. All right, we're going to go beyond 1962. Yes, we'll hop in the Wayback Machine with Mr. Peabody here. Go back to 1961. We'll take another look at the 61 Topps set, even though aesthetically it comes up short compared to a lot of other cards that Topps released in the previous few years and would release in the next few years. There's a good reason for it. As Major League Baseball's first expansion in 1961 threw Topps their first curveball. So how that made a difference, what is so special about the 61 Topps set, and why, yes, like you, or like me, you should take a look at 61 Topps all over again. I'm Matt Salmon, your host of Wax Ecstatic. Thanks for joining us again. And make sure you join us in 2 weeks, Friday, September 25th. We'll talk 61 Topps. And you can talk baseball anytime with us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And don't forget, cardboard or cash donations, always appreciated. You can reach out to us at paypal.me/waxecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.